Good evening, listeners and students of Hitler's Table Talk. The date is February 12, 2015, and tonight we're bringing you episode 46. My name is Carolyn Yeager, and I don't have Ray Goodwin here with me yet, but I assume he may, you know, sometimes they don't answer his call, and sometimes the call doesn't work right away. So I'll just continue on here until he does show up. We're going to be dealing with some very interesting topics tonight, and we're starting out on July 24th, 1942. The timeline for July 24th is the Germans take Rostov on the Don, and the Red Army is in a general retreat along the Don River. So this is good news for the Germans. They've taken control of the city of Rostov. So we go on to July 24th, 1942, at dinner. The topics are, the discussion is about what to expect from the Dutch, a poor people that tolerated Wilhelm II, the husbands of Wilhelmina and Juliana, the popularity of the Duce, claims on Europe's gratitude, Italy, land of internal struggles, sabotage against the Duce. When people tell me that the Dutch will not make good SS men, I always remember the cartoons of Spitzweg, who represented the German soldiers of the South German states sitting and knitting socks. But 20 years of instruction have put a very different complexion on the matter. A race like the Dutch, which has shown itself capable of organizing a magnificent Far Eastern air service, and which produces a host of first-class seamen, can easily be taught to assimilate the military spirit. One must not lose faith in the essential soundness of the race, for sound it certainly is. I want to mention here about this that Spitzweg, is not really a cartoonist, although he did humorous paintings and pictures. He is a fantastic artist. He did a lot of paintings of Germans that were in humorous situations and poses and painted them in a humorous way. And so I think for that reason Hitler's calling them cartoons. And it's very, very likely that he would have painted German soldiers from Bavaria, knitting socks, just kind of making fun of somehow their very conservative way of life or something. And not conservative, but their bourgeois mentality. So, but now here he's saying that the people are criticizing the Dutch, and he has hopes for the Dutch, saying that they have a great race. We have to remember the soundness of the race, for they can improve themselves from what they have kind of degraded themselves to, I would say. I would put it that way. So, next paragraph here. Hitler says, I well remember how completely staggered I was when an industrialist of the stature of Kierdorf, while promising me his full support for our movement, declared that there was only one thing I must not ask of him. Namely, belief in the success of our campaign. A people, he said, who tamely put up with a Kaiser like Wilhelm II was, in his opinion, too inherently lazy to be capable of any renaissance. That Kierdorf was too pessimistic in his assessment of our people is shown by the fact that the ex-monarchs and the members of the former ruling houses have been completely forgotten by the nation, even during their lifetime. Who cares a rap, for instance, for Ruprecht of Bavaria? Kingship possesses but little wisdom, and the boundary between the throne and the madhouse is a slender one. If we can succeed in getting rid of the King of Belgium by giving him a pension of $500,000 or so, and thus ensuring for him a gilded exile, I, for one, shall be heartily thankful. In Holland, thank goodness, things are much easier, for in Prince von Lippe-Biesterfeld, we have an absolute imbecile oaf on the throne. When, before his marriage, he came to pay me a farewell visit, He cringed and scraped like a gigolo. A couple of days later, he declared in the Dutch press that in his heart, he had always felt himself a Dutchman. The late prince consort of Queen Wilhelmina was also a typical royal idiot. He even had the impertinence to approach me shortly after our assumption of power for a loan of 7.5 million guilders in return for his assurance that he would then do all in his power to increase German influence in Holland, not only among crowned heads, but also among the so-called upper 10,000. Stupidity and pride are proverbial. Again and again, I have had to defend the Duce in certain circles of society, pointing out to them that without him, Italy would certainly have become a communist state. And again, these same circles have dismissed him as a broken man and a spent force. I'll just point out now, Queen Wilhelmina is the Dutch queen, and this is a Kierdorf. The industrialist is very well known and has played a big role even in the talk, anti-Hitler talk, about getting all this support from the industrialists and so on. But Kierdorf was an early supporter because he didn't like communism. And he supported Hitler because he thought Hitler was the one who had the ability to stop the communists from taking over Germany. He said that he didn't have much faith in the German people because they had tolerated such bad rulers in the past. So then Hitler goes on to talk about I don't know if I read this, I'm going to read it again. Hitler says that the Duce's political activity is considerably impeded by royal prerogative. It is, for example, all but impossible to assume the leadership of a country if the armed forces thereof owe allegiance to another. No business firm could be efficiently run by the managing director if some other shareholder held a majority of shares and was thus in a position to alter or cancel orders at will. Unless legislative and administrative power are in one hand, endless difficulties will arise. What's he saying there? He's saying that these leaders of countries could not run a business, is what he's saying. And he mentions the Duce here, and he's talking about the difficulties that he's had in Italy with the church and so on, and the royalty and court and the nobility. And so it brings up the Lateran Treaty, which was an agreement in 1929 between the Kingdom of Italy, which was already under a fascist state under Mussolini. Because Mussolini took power all the way in 1922, when Hitler was just getting started. Mussolini signed this agreement between the Holy See and the state, and the Vatican City, which settled the Roman question. It had come to be called the Roman question. And this Lateran Treaty recognized the full sovereignty of the Holy See and Vatican City as a separate state, exempt from all taxes. And they were supposed to stay out of the affairs of state and not interfere with what the government wanted to do. And this is a problem that the church never wants to stay out of business of the ruling the people. So, because it thinks that it's responsible for the people's soul and all of that. So it and in religious training. So it feels like sometimes things impede on that, and they have to speak up and. And there, then you have the problem. So Hitler then says, when we Germans pass judgment on the Duce, we must bear all these considerations well in mind. So as we mentioned in an earlier time, you know, the Germans were starting to, and people in Hitler's circle were starting to complain about the Italians and maybe saying that the Mussolini wasn't doing all that he should be doing to keep them all in line and to make them do better. But now Hitler is saying we must not forget that when all is said and done, it is the Duce we have to thank for the fact that Italy is not in the war on the side of the Allies. When some aspects of our alliance with Italy appear irksome to us, let us not forget that the king and his court have much too far-reaching powers of intervention, both in military matters and in affairs of state. Even the prefects are appointed by the crown. The Duce, I know, says that does not worry him, because he had guarded against the danger of a few prefects intriguing against him by seeing to it that some of his most stalwart and trustworthy fascists are always put on the prefectorial nomination list. But he has to act as swift as lightning and be ready with his recommendation the very second a prefecture falls vacant. If he is in the least tardy, the post is immediately filled by some court sycophant. What that means, I have myself seen in Rome. So we've heard Hitler defend Mussolini before, and you might say blame his problems on the noble class that he has to deal with, because there's still a king of Italy and a court and all of that, and on the church. So he's doing this again, and he feels a lot of gratitude to Mussolini and thinks a lot of him, and will always stand up for him. Very similar in my mind to what was going on toward the end of the war with Hermann Göring, or maybe even before the end of the war, when he was being criticized as not doing the best job as running the Luftwaffe and wanting people saying he should be replaced, and Hitler not being able to shame, you know, embarrass him by replacing him, and remembering always all that Göring had done for him in the early years, and what a great advantage he brought to National Socialism when he came and joined the party, because he had a reputation. Hitler was always grateful for that and always pleased that Göring was a National Socialist. And Göring did a lot of good until he started kind of falling down and promising things that he could do which he couldn't do, which he was not able to do, not being as realistic as he should have been. Anyway, that's another instance where Hitler is defending someone who's being criticized, and probably for good reason. I mean, criticized for good reason. Then Hitler goes on to say, "I could scarcely believe my eyes when I saw how shamelessly the Queen behaved towards the Duce." It went, obviously, when he was in Italy visiting. "And how the court clique was always pressed to the fore. Never have I seen the necessity for a militia better demonstrated. When I said this to the Duce, he laughed, and he said that under present circumstances, even he could not carry on with only the executive power of the police behind him. The upper 10,000 of Italy, instead of realizing that a victory for communism would mean their own immediate annihilation, and instead, therefore, of giving him all the support they could, placed difficulty after difficulty in his way in the struggle against the Bolsheviks. They were as little conscious of the tremendous assistance they were giving the Bolsheviks as the stupid calf, of which it is said, the stupid calf chooses its own butcher." He's using a German saying to describe that, of these stupid people. The upper 10,000 and upper 20,000 and so on are the elite of the country, the wealthy and the aristocratic and the ones with family going way back and so on. He thinks that they're not the best people. Of course, he wanted to find his party members from the people, from the real people, the common people, and that is what he did. So that's the end of that section. Looks like we're not going to get Ray on here. Thus, we'll go on to the 26th of July, 1942. And there's a timeline. On the 26th, a second attack by the British under Auchinleck fails against Rommel. First battle of El Alamein may be said to be over. So we're having the British are not making any headway against Rommel, and therefore Rommel may have be said, I guess they mean, to have won that first battle at El Alamein. Now this is midday, and the subjects are oil fields in the Caucasus and elsewhere, Russian methods, and the value of gas propellants. The presence of oil in the Caucasus, in the vicinity of Vienna and in the Harz, leads one to suspect the existence of an oil field of whose magnitude and importance one had not the least idea. This is not in the least surprising. As in the case of mineral wealth, the trust would immediately buy up any newly discovered oil-bearing territories with the intention of restricting their development to a degree compatible with the other interests in this. Their primary object would be to prevent exploitation by others. One must give the Russians their due and admit that, in this respect, they have succeeded in limiting the power of the monopolies and eliminating private interests. As a result, they are now in a position to prospect throughout their territory for oil, whose position and probable extension are studied by experts with the assistance of very large-scale maps. In this way, they have not only been able to trace the course of the oil veins, but have also verified their facts and extended their knowledge by test borings carried out at the expense of the state. There is a lot we can learn from them. There is no limit to what we could have extracted from the sources in the vicinity of Vienna. The state had undertaken the necessary exploitation in time. This added to the oil well. I made two sentences out of that. He's saying that there's no limit to what we could have extracted in the vicinity of Vienna if the state had undertaken the necessary exploitation in time. I guess he thinks it's too late now to do it. Yeah, I guess it would take too long. This, added to the oil wells of the Caucasus and Romania, would have saved us from all anxiety for the future. One must not, however, forget that oil wells are not inexhaustible. And that is why I am still in favor of gas-driven public vehicles, and particularly of gas-driven vehicles for the party. Of course, gas driven in those days was a different kind of a gas than the petrol, which is the word he uses for that kind of gas that we use in our cars now. It's a different kind of gas. He says, I advocate this not only as a precaution for the future, but also as a means of reducing the cost of transportation. For 12 pfennig, one can cover the same distance in a gas-driven car as one can with a liter of petrol in an ordinary car, and petrol costs 40 pfennig a liter. In the northern countries, and particularly in Finland, charcoal is plentiful. In Germany, we have lignite in abundance, and in the Ukraine, there are the briquettes made from the limitless straw, which yearly rots on its own. So basically, again, they've got this oil problem, and he's talking about the sources and saying that we better stick with our different kinds of gas, with producer gas and Holtz gas and various names it had, to run our vehicles and use other sources, because this petrol is pretty hard for us to get. Next section is 26th of July at dinner in 1942. And the subjects are do's and don'ts for civil servants, the temptations to corruption, Caesar's wife, the old state servant and private business, and a few swindlers. Well, this is an interesting one. And we're also going to hear comments from other people as we go through it, other people who are there after dinner. The Fuhrer asked Bormann whether the necessary steps had been taken to make it illegal for any member of the Reichstag to sit on the board of directors of any private concern. Bormann replied that the matter had been deferred until the end of the war and suggested that Lammers should be asked to give a detailed explanation in his next report. The Fuhrer was horrified at this reply and said, no servant of the state must be a shareholder, no Gauleiter, no member of the Reichstag, and in general, no party leader must be a member of any board of directors, regardless of whether the appointment is honorary or paid. For even if the individual were actuated solely by the interests of the state, and even if he possessed the integrity of Cato himself, the public would lose faith in him. In capitalist states, it is essential for a great enterprise to have in its employ men of influence. Hence the large number of members of parliament and high officials who figure on boards of directors. The amounts disbursed to these personages in directors' fees share of profits, and so on, is more than recouped by one or two fat government contracts, which they are in a position to secure for their company. Well, so here he's talking about what we're so familiar with and was a topic of conversation in the U.S. Some years ago, nobody talks about it much anymore, but I guess there wasn't as much other stuff to talk about then. So that came into discussion. It was called the In-N-Out doorway or something like that. I can't think of the way that was described, but people working for government and then leaving government and going to work in private business, and then sometimes leaving private business or the different ones, coming from private business into government, and sometimes it's the same man who's going back and forth a few times. That's called something like the revolving door. And this is what Hitler says is not going to happen in Germany, and he's never intended for anything like that to be allowed, and he's horrified if some of this is happening. And so he goes on with some examples. He says the Danube Shipping Company, for example, paid out 80,000 kronen a year to each of the dozen members of parliament who sat on its board of directors. But it recouped itself many times over for this expenditure through the influence these men were able to exercise in its favor. All competition was eliminated, and a virtual monopoly was gained, all to the detriment of the state, or, in other words, of the community. It must therefore be accepted as an absolute principle that no member of the Reichstag, no civil servant, and no party leader must be in any way connected with business of this nature. The common people have a remarkable flair for anything of this kind. When I decided to buy a property, my choice lay between the Berghof and a property at Steingaden, which is probably in the same neighborhood. Fortunately, I chose the Berghof. If I had taken the Steingarten place, I should have been compelled to become a producer of the famous Steingaden cheese in order to keep the place up. Suppose then that for some reason or other the price of cheese went up. Everybody would immediately say, of course, the Fuhrer is himself personally interested in the price of cheese. Well, again, we have the note taker saying, this viewpoint of the Fuhrer was supported by Field Marshal Keitel, who told the following story. The former food minister, Hugenberg, had energetically encouraged the campaign undertaken by the state to promote the consumption of milk. When his own lorries carrying milk from his own properties passed through the streets, plastered with posters of the official campaign, everybody said that the real object of the exercise was to bolster the sales of the minister's milk business. He's meaning, I'm sure, that this Hugenberg was innocent, that it was just happened to be his job as food minister to encourage this milk campaign, even though he himself had milk cows on his properties. Hitler's just saying that this is the kind of thing that causes people to talk, whether there's a basis for it or not. So the Fuhrer continued, when an official retires from state service, he should not be allowed to enter a line of business with which he previously had official dealings. For one may be quite sure that any firm would gladly employ him, not on account of the services he could render, but for the connections which he undoubtedly would have. If this were not so, then directors would not earn fees amounting to 36,000 marks a year and more. Further, it is a scandal that men of this kind should usurp the positions to which others have a prior claim, namely, those who have passed their whole lives in the service of an enterprise and have risen step by step to the top. This one characteristic is alone sufficient to demonstrate the immorality of the whole system. Big business is as hot on the trail of such connections as the devil after the soul of a Jew. That's the way Hitler talked, and that's the way they talked in National Socialism. Wasn't unusual to use sayings like that. Hitler goes on, if once one permit a Gauleiter to become a shareholder or a director in some industrial undertaking, One will not be able to prevent the Kreisleiter, the mayor, and other German officials from doing the same, and that would spell the beginning of corruption. For all these reasons, we must see to it that any state official who has invested all his money in shares should forthwith invest in state loans instead. So he said, this, as the field marshal rightly remarks, was a practice in the old army, in the old imperial army. An officer was not allowed to invest either his own fortune or the dowry of his wife in a private industrial concern, but was expected to subscribe to state loans recommended and guaranteed by the state. This was a good system, for it guaranteed that the private interests of the officer, like those of the state official, were bound indissolubly to the interests of the state. After all, the state does not exist in order to raise a man to a high social level and give him the best of everything, only to see him later slip away from under its aegis. Well, that's what our states do. Now, yeah, the United States seems to exist to bring people who are accepted into the political class to a high social level and have the best of everything. Well, so now Admiral Kronka asks what the attitude of the state would be towards an employee who made some invention. The Fuhrer replied, if the invention is of an epoch-making nature, it will be taken over by the state, and the inventor will receive an appropriate remuneration in state bonds. The admiral then asked whether an officer retiring voluntarily from the service should also be precluded from entering private business. The Fuhrer replied, I very much doubt if a retired mayor has the ability to fill any post in business, even that of an accountant. We had enough trouble at the end of the First War finding uses for the demobilized officer. One must further draw a sharp distinction between those who retire from state service with the object of entering business and those who are permitted to retire on account of their inefficiency. To discourage state officials from constantly bearing in mind the possibility of a switchover to private business, the state must make sure that in its agreements with large undertakings, it never grants a monopoly. Whenever there is a question of a large contract, it must always be split up between three or four of the firms competing for it. Only in this way can one prevent commercially minded civil servants from building for themselves golden bridges to certain firms. Further, the granting of big contracts must be made by committee, the members of which are constantly being changed. So, you know, you don't keep the same people on the committee either who's making these decisions about who you're granting big contracts. You keep changing it. Purchasing commissions on behalf of the Army should always be composed of select officers recalled from the front for the purpose of having no connections whatsoever with the industries concerned. If there is any sign that they are being tempted, especially with invitations to shooting parties, they must be relieved instantly. I say shooting parties because shooting and hunting have the same effect on officers as jewels have on women. Now, I thought that was very funny because Hitler's talked before about his view of shooting parties and hunting parties that all the men like so much, all the men except him, it seems, pretty much, and all of his fellow ministers and his military officers and so on. They all like that, and he thinks it's a place where no good goes on, comparing it to the effect that jewels have on women. When men are invited to a shooting party, they just, oh, gosh, they've got to go. They're all excited. The industrialists are experts, Hitler says, in all these arts of corruption, and their skill is the result of many years of experience. This explains the cool audacity with which they pursue their aims. On one occasion, they even approached me and tried to get my support for something or other, in which the Fuhrer's signature would have raked in a packet of capital for them, and they dangled before me a bunch of shares, to be given, of course, to any charity I cared to select. The alchemist Tausend, by making skillful use of the name of Ludendorff, who had fallen into the trap, extorted 4 million marks from a small group of industrialists, 900,000 from Mannesmann alone, to finance his further experiments. See, he's saying these men fall into these traps by these skillful, what he's going to use the word a little bit later, swindlers. Even Ludendorff did so. If an officer of Ludendorff's high qualities can become the dupe of a swindler, all the more reason to see that other more ordinary folk, like officers allowed to retire for reasons of inefficiency, are prevented from entering business. That officers are unsuited for business activities is shown by Ludendorff's failure when he tried, with Captain Weiss, to found a newspaper. Even the most capable businessman is sometimes caught by the swindler. I am thinking of Roselius, who extracted the caffeine from coffee and sold it at a high price as a medicine, and then sold his processed coffee at a price above that of normal coffee. Well, even this astute Roselius was caught by a crook who claimed to be able to transform dirty water into pure water. Shortly after I came to power, Roselius forced my hand, and I consented to receive this eminent person. I only had to hear this great inventor speak for a moment to discover that he was a complete crook. Then the minister for church affairs, of course, had to fall into the hands of another soi-disant, that's a French word for self-styled, another self-styled inventor, who claimed to be able to extract petrol from coal by means of a process with water. Oh, there he is. Hey. Do this right here. I wonder how long he's been waiting. Hi, Ray.
Hey there.
Wow, I'm glad you're here.
Oh, me too. Can you hear me, Carolyn?
I hear you just fine. What happened?
Oh, my sincerest apologies. I've been listening about 7 or 8 minutes, but what happened was allergies and all this stuff, and I took an allergy pill, a Claritin or whatever, I didn't know it was going to knock me out, and I woke up and I looked at that clock and I said, no, it can't be that, and I'm embarrassed. I'm really sorry.
That's really interesting, because I've been having sleeping problems that I never used to have, and a friend of mine said that she had such bad sleeping problems, and what she does is take histamines, things like Claritin and so on, and I've read that that's not the best thing to do, but it sure puts you to sleep, and she said it's the only thing that puts you to sleep. So, yeah, you got to watch out for that. So have you been waiting online for 7 or 8 minutes now,
yep.
And I was so concentrated. Uh-huh. I was trying to keep looking over there, but I guess I finally gave up on it. And I've been concentrating on my reading. And so
I was enjoying you.
Oh, well.
You did quite well.
Well, I can do it, but you do it better. And I also, my voice is starting to get a little tired, so I'm glad you showed up. So we're in this fun section where he's talking about the swindlers. I really like it. But
yes.
I just finished to discover that he was a complete crook. And then he starts off the minister for church affairs. Oh, I already read that.
Yes, I'm right with you.
Oh, are you? Okay. Well, you go ahead and take over then.
Yeah, you said that soi-disant, this self-styled inventor.
Mm-hmm.
And let's see, you were...
Even Kepler.
Yeah, okay. Even Kepler allowed himself to be led by the nose for nearly a year by the same sharper who really did produce petrol for his dupe's inspection, but it was petrol procured from other sources. When things at last got too hot for this particular swindler, he tried to get a safe conduct out of the country. But Himmler, who originally had believed in him, had given him instead a carte d'entrée for one of the concentration camps, where he was able to continue his experiments in peace. If such swindles are possible here in this country, said Bormann, what must it be like in a place like the United States?
Now, I have to stop here. I thought that was the funniest line of all. You know, I've been enjoying this whole section. But when Bormann said that, I just, you know, broke up because, you know, Bormann has the attitude that everybody has, although he probably has it even worse, that he doesn't like the United States. And he said that, you know, that it's full of crooks and swindlers and Jews and so on.
That's right.
And,
That's right.
And so you think, wow, what must it be like there?
Yeah.
If we even get swindled here in Germany, where we don't tolerate that kind of thing. So I said, good for Bormann. That's a good
line. That's right.
All right.
The Führer continued, Germany's strength lies in the fact that the men of the party, the state, and the armed forces take no part in business. And those of them who still have any connection with business must now make their final decision. Either they must abandon all such connections, or they must resign from their official positions.
Okay.
So that is,
well, this was really interesting, wasn't it? Because he's right. I believe it, absolutely. They didn't tolerate corruption in
Germany. That's right.
It was not a corrupt state, and most... Now, that's the difference between, I don't want to be picking on people, but that's the difference between Western and Eastern Europe. Now, they say that the Western Europeans do worse kind of high-level evil than the simple little corruption in Eastern Europe, but I don't like when corruption goes on in a state. It's a mess.
Yeah, you know, what Hitler's really hammering at here is a position of conflict of interest, as we would call it over here, and you know exactly what he's talking about, the business world and politicians and things like this. And boy, he hit the nail right on the head. He said you can't mix the two. You can't have an individual who is part of a corporation to be in the military or vice versa. I mean, that's exactly what they make a living at over here.
And we can conclude that Hitler is a very moral and honest man, and he ran the nation that way, and he ran the military that way, and he had Himmler doing that, and he had insisted on that with everyone, and that was the way things were, and that should be emphasized more than it is.
So okay. That's right.
All right, well, I've
got
a timeline for the 27th, Ray.
Okay.
The 27th of July, 1942, there was a heavy RAF incendiary attack on Hamburg. But they didn't talk about it. This 42 one was pretty bad. It was pretty bad.
Right. Okay, the 27th of July, 1942, at dinner, Russia's floating population, the lure of the South, German bureaucracy, and the nomads. Ambassador Hewell reported that the commissar of a neighboring town had told him that a large number of Russians were applying for laissez-passer, apparently to go to the Crimea. Most of these applicants came with wives and families from Leningrad, the Führer said. But that is ridiculous. Here I am trying to empty the Crimea in order to make way for our own colonists, and our command post issue laissez-passer to any and every Russian who applies for one. And it's only by chance that it comes to my knowledge. Has anyone, I wonder, taken the trouble to think why these Russians wish to immigrate? Primarily, of course, it is the attraction of the South. They all know that the climate of the Crimea is more temperate, their stock of warm clothing is meager in the extreme, and last winter was a particularly severe one. The Russians have not that love of homeland which is characteristic of the German peasant. Even in the time of the Czars, millions used to immigrate, and the hope of being able to avoid taxes was not the least of their motives. for the mass immigration period usually coincided with the arrival of the imperial tax collectors. Correctly, to appreciate the mentality of these people, one must realize that they are nomadic. The wanderlust is as inherent in them as it is in a herd of beasts. When they've denuded one district, they wander on in search of fresh pastures. This explains why Russians are always ready to abandon even a valuable possession like a wagon if it impedes their move onwards. I cannot help but grinning when I think what a heaven-sent field of activity these people constitute for our bureaucrats. I can already see in my mind's eye some of the measures they will introduce. First of all, a sort of journey book to be duly stamped on departure from each pasturage. Then a ban on certain routes, with the routes not so banned made compulsory. And a tidbit will be the battle of the bureaucrats to decide who shall have the right to administer these gypsies. Will it be the military authorities or the Ministry of Internal Affairs? Might it not even be the Ministry of Foreign Affairs? They surely will stake a claim on the grounds that some of these nomads might, on one fine day, wish to go beyond even the far-flung frontiers of the German Reich of the future.
Mm-hmm. Well, they've got immigration problems then.
Yes.
People wanting to move somewhere else where it looks like it'd be better for them. Boy, the immigration in Europe is getting just terrible lately. It's just horrendous.
Right.
Everybody now has the idea that if things are bad in their lousy, stinking country, I'm sorry for saying that, shouldn't say stinking, in their badly run country, well, then they're going to go into the European Union, right in the center of it, maybe to Berlin, and have a better life. And this is, I read today, Ray, just not too long ago, that Germany was even sending policemen down to Serbia-Hungary border where they're trying to, put a stop to these, I guess they're basically Bosnians, but they're Muslims coming across into Hungary and on their way to Germany. And Germany's horrified by it. But they only sent 20 of them. It said they sent 20 policemen. But 20 German policemen can do quite a bit if they're real experienced and can kind of tell the others, help the others what they're doing. But that was a new one on me, that Germany would do that. So, well, I wish they'd do a whole lot more, like pass some laws to say these people can't come. Now, that would be, it's the only thing that would work. But, well, okay,
right.
That was my comment on that.
Okay. July, 28th of July, 1942, midday. The transport of grain. The question under discussion was whether 100,000 tons of grain captured at Morozovskaya should be transferred to Germany. It represented 2 million sacks, or 40 million 7-pound loaves. The Fuhrer gave his opinion as follows. 100,000 tons, that rings a bell in my memory. It was exactly the amount I had to find fighting like a lion so that the Swabian should not be deprived of their beloved Spatzel. Is that S-P-A-T-Z-L-E?
Yeah.
Spatzel, yeah. It's a food. I do not believe in the theory that all foodstuffs must be distributed equally throughout the Reich. Common sense dictates that the Swabians should have their Spatzel, and Munich should get its beer, Vienna a little more coffee and white bread, and for the Berliners an extra ration of charcuterie. For there is no doubt about it, the morale of the people is dependent to quite a considerable degree on a sympathetic understanding of and catering for the little things that make life more pleasant for them. This grain from Morozovskaya should, I think, be sent to Germany and distributed among the workers in heavy industry.
Yeah. We had something like Spatzel in my house growing up, but not as a regular thing, a special with special German kind of meals, but we didn't call it that. But anyway, I think we called it by its Hungarian name. Most, you know, I was thinking about that. I didn't notice that my grandparents brought, or the others and all their friends and so on, brought Hungarian traditions at all with them. Everything was German except the food, the cuisine. They had picked up the Hungarian cuisine, and I'm not surprised because it's better than German. It really is. German food is okay, but it's not that great. Some of it's pretty good, but the Hungarian is really, really good, and a lot of it is similar. They would just do it differently, and there was with the number of things, there was a lot of paprika. So then I know it was Hungarian, and they had sort of German and sometimes Hungarian names to it. But that was I found that interesting to think about how the one thing that you pick up from another place might be simply the cooking, the food. And maybe they only did that because they found it was pretty darn good. So
yeah.
That's my comment there on Spatula.
Yeah, well, that's good. And, you know, at the end there, it's like Hitler said, you've got to be considerate, have a sympathetic understanding, and caring for the little things that make life more pleasant for the little folks, so to speak.
He doesn't want to encourage any discontent and unhappiness because of little things like this, you know.
That's right.
Whatever
That's
these
right.
people are used to, try our best to see that they can still have it rather than say, heck with you, you know, too bad we don't have that now. And then people become more unhappy. So, yeah, there's a double edge there. It's a consideration for the people, but it's also consideration for the government, you might say, that they don't stir up, that they try to keep people happy. Interesting that the Viennese wanted coffee and white bread. Boy, that's right on, you know. And I don't know what the charcuterie is. I didn't look it up.
No, me either. But, you know, underneath the text here, it does say spatzle, S-P-A-T-Z-L-E. It says a sort of dumpling greatly liked by the Swabians. So
Yeah, I saw that too. It was added. It's funny that they added that.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, for it.
But I wouldn't call it a dumpling, but I guess if you don't know, you'd say a sort of dumpling. I'm looking up this charc, charcuterie word. See what I find.
Yeah.
Oh, there's a picture of meat here. How to serve charcuterie. It looks like meat or fish, probably. Yeah, there's a bunch of hams hanging there now. It's flesh cooked, French. Of course, it's a French word. Northern French, Southern French, flesh, and preparing meat products such as bacon, ham, sausage. It's a way to prepare meat products, primarily from pork. Well, it's something that some people are used to. And who did he say like that? The Berliners. The Berliners went for that. Okay.
Okay. The 29th of July, 1942, midday, men and machines. During the First World War, we had to wait until 1918 before the Army consented to release 40,000 workmen needed urgently for the construction of submarines. In 1917, the military authorities refused to make available the men required for the manufacture of tanks. In this, the High Command committed a fatal error, sacrificing a potentially tremendous improvement in war technique in order to avoid a decrease in their available manpower. For the decisive factor in any war is the possession of the technically superior weapons. Our main preoccupation today must be to maintain the lead we have already gained in this respect, which has been the foundation of our great victories up to date. If we do, we shall be able to wage and win this war at a third of the cost in casualties which we inflict on our foes. It would, therefore, be the height of folly to insist in retaining in the Army specialists in submarine construction. The net result would be that the British would be able to blast their way through to Archangel with a convoy carrying 1,000 tanks and as many aircraft. And then the Army and the Air Force would have to destroy them all in bloody and single combat, and with losses many times greater than the number of men demanded from the Wehrmacht for the construction of submarines. If during the First War 500,000 technicians had been released from the Army at the appropriate moment, say after the Battle of Cambrai, for the construction of armored fighting vehicles and particularly of tanks, then instead of our 2 million casualties, our total would certainly not have exceeded 1 million. In this connection, too, it must be remembered that death comes in a flash. While the technician can spend 360 days a year fashioning the most perfect armaments of the age and saving the soldiers' untold loss of life. Of equal importance is the construction of minesweepers, for without them, supplies of iron ore from Sweden cannot be maintained, since the British mine the fairway with an absolutely devilish persistence. The result of any lack of minesweepers are manifold. Firstly, weapon production would decrease through lack of iron ore, and casualties at the front would therefore increase through lack of armaments. Secondly, the absence of minesweepers would allow the British to mine the fairways essential to our submarines, thus both jeopardizing their efficiency and increasing their losses. Construction of submarines and minesweepers and the release from the armed forces of technicians required for the task are therefore of primary and equal importance. The more submarines we have in service, the larger will be our requirements for maintenance and repairs, and this must also be borne in mind when deciding the numbers of technicians to be released. And boy, there's a pertinent military statement, too, a recognition of where we need personnel and when we need them.
Hitler's always saying, or he regularly says, consistently says this, that the superiority of your weapons is what will win, is what wins battles. Even if you have best men and everything, he knows that superior weapons can't be overcome. And so he's very conscious of that. Now here he's saying that when you want every man to be in the fighting troops, and you've got all these people who can build these things, and technicians and otherwise, and scientists and so on, that's pretty stupid. You need to take that other just as seriously as you do your fighting troops.
Sure.
They're just as valuable. I'd say probably more valuable because there's fewer of them. You know, that's a select group that is capable
of
developing new weapons. And
I was just going to say what he's drawing here is a picture of World War One, in which, of course, he was a participant, and you had high-level military commanders saying, well, we can't let these men go. We've got to maintain our level of command here, and it'll run us short of people.
Yeah.
Instead of thinking these personnel that they need to be working, building on tanks and other weapons of war, we've got to let them go and get with that. And it was very short-sighted and it's very costly.
And Hitler being in that war for the duration really helped him a lot and really taught him a lot.
Sure.
For his work that came upon him.
From what you were saying there, and which is certainly correct, that his experience as a frontline soldier in World War One was very invaluable in
mm-hmm.
his way of looking at things and his shrewdness in taking into consideration the what others might consider trivial things or whatever, that he was aware of so very much because he had been one of the soldiers in the trenches. He had been one of the men who faced the depredation of war on the very front lines and was aware of what the military, the guy in the trenches, needed most of all. And
mm-hmm.
he brought that experience forward into his position as he has at this point.
You know, the leaders of the First World War were so bad compared to how much they improved in the Second World War. They really
were. That's exactly right.
Bumbling. Idiots, horrible. It just killed, let millions of men die because of their stupidity and their lack of imagination or whatever. And he's giving some examples of it. I'm surprised he doesn't speak. He's not speaking more angrily than he is.
Well, if I may draw a parallel there, Carolyn, you know, as teaching American history, one of the few advantages that the Americans had in their Revolutionary War against the British was the British regimentation about how to fight a battle. You line up your soldiers, you march out there and meet face to face and just blow away with artillery and rifle fire until somebody wavers and starts to run. Well, the American forces, ragtag as they were, they got some military training, but it was more of a hit-and-run, a guerrilla-type tactic that was quite successful. The British are standing back and saying, wait a minute, this is not a way to fight a war, when the Americans would ambush them and hide behind trees and run into forests. Well, it's the same thing. In World War One, you had the trench warfare, get in the trench, go on an aggressive assault and capture 300 or 400 or 500 yards worth of territory and be driven away from it the next minute. And then you compare that with the Blitzkrieg in World War II, the artillery, the tanks, the strategy was entirely different. And that's exactly what you're saying there. The great difference in the military leadership and the tactics of World War II compared to World War I made all the difference in the world as far as military success.
Mm-hmm. Right, and Hitler is the one who designed that Western offensive, which is the beginning of the war, mm-hmm. of the war against England. And
yeah.
he designed that whole thing because he didn't want the same old usual stuff at all, and he came up with something very different. It's all been given... Manstein has been given credit for it, but also that general, can't think of his name now, that Hitler finally had to fire. He took credit for it too, but it wasn't him. It was Hitler who dreamed all that up. And Manstein was having the same idea, but he hadn't done anything about it except I used to write about it a little bit. But Hitler had by then had a whole plan, and he had been working with big map things and movable stuff in his headquarters with his aides and so on, and been got it all worked out how they were going to go about that Western offensive, and it was extremely successful. So that boosted his prestige quite a bit amongst everybody, even his own generals. They had to say, wow, well, I guess we can't put him down anymore.
Right.
Like
man,
they were wanting to do. Right.
Sure.
Okay, on the 30th, there's a timeline. What happened there then was that nothing. It's just the same stalemate at El Alamein between Rommel and Auchinleck. They seem to think they need to say that.
Yeah. Okay, 29th of July, 1942, at dinner. The sculptor Kreiss, German art and the Jews, 1,200 masterpieces at Munich. The Artist's Dilemma. The monument erected at La Baux to the memory of the submarine service is, with its distorted bows, a singularly pernicious piece of art. I am only thankful, therefore, that we now have in Professor Kreiss an artist in stone capable of the most magnificent designs for all future war memorials. Bormann then showed the Führer some photos of the pictures exhibited at the biennial exhibition in Venice. The Führer commented, "To my mind, the complete lack of technique in these incredible daubs represent the ultimate prostitution of art. Public reception, according to reports I've received, throws a significant light on the value of this exhibition. When they saw the pictures, the public apparently simply burst out laughing. Such a thing would not happen at an exhibition in the House of German Art in Munich. The 1,200 works accepted for the Munich exhibition, out of some 10 or 12,000 submitted, were without exception first-class works of art, the meticulousness of the selection was assured because it was not carried out by artists themselves, but by men of the caliber of Professor Hoffman and Director Kolb. Artists as selectors are somewhat prone to select for exhibition a certain number of mediocre works, which then serve as an excellent foil for their own pictures. The value of the Munich exhibition is twofold. It ensures that the purchaser of any picture can safely hang it in his home with pride, and it contributes greatly to the education of the artist. I have inexorably adhered to the following principle. If some self-styled artist submits trash for the Munich exhibition, then he is either a swindler, in which case he should be put in prison, or he's a madman, in which case he should be in an asylum, or he is a degenerate, in which case he must be sent to a concentration camp to be re-educated and taught the dignity of honest labor. In this way, I have ensured that the Munich exhibition is avoided like the plague by the inefficient. The approval of my viewpoint by the German people, expressed in the terms of the millions who visit the exhibition, is a source of the keenest satisfaction to me. And there he is once again, Carolyn Moore, with his love of art and the beauty of real art.
Well, and he's also promoting, in a way, he's promoting what he's done and what the art that his regime is standing for, National Socialism stands for, and in comparison to what he sees is clearly to him just really junk that's being put up on around the rest of the world. Now, people can think it's wonderful and inventive and innovative and so on, but he doesn't see it that way. Again, he uses those words, daubs. But I thought it was very funny when he said that artists are not the best ones to select works of art because they would pick out a certain amount of bad art so that their art would look good in comparison. I think that's true. I think that's funny.
Not that
the other people would necessarily be that good about it, but at least they'd be more detached. Then I thought it was just really funny when he talked about if you're a bad artist, you're a swindler, and therefore you should either go to a prison or to an asylum or to a concentration camp. Well, that's just typical. He's having fun saying that, but I thought it was pretty funny. He just has such strong views about art, and I think he's been proved right. And, I know what I liked about this. I thought it was kind of touching or something that he said that this annual exhibition in Munich was all the art was by Germans. You know, they entered it and it was selected, 1,000 out of about 10,000 entries or more. So they had to get rid of a lot of it. And if it was selected, he said, he knows it wasn't all great art, but he said at least you can, if you buy it and hang it in your home, you can be confident then that you've got something you don't have to be ashamed of, because the fact is that a lot of people buy really bad stuff and then they hang it up and maybe other people would come along and say, boy, that guy really doesn't have any taste whatsoever. Might not say that to him, to their face, but he's saying that if you're uncertain about art and your judgments, if you buy something from that exhibition, you can feel confident that it's not a piece of junk and, it's good art and you can hang it in your home and feel good about it. And that's so true, because I know the stuff that people will select on their own that is really just bad, bad, bad. But for some reason, something about it they like, and they don't know any better. Okay, where do we go next?
Okay, this next section for the 1st of August, 1942 evening is lengthy, but we may be able to knock it out. Interestingly, under that date in the textbook, it has bracketed note by translator. The text for this day is very disjointed and confusedly written, with even grammatical mistakes in the German.
Yeah, I got that too. And, I think that was unnecessary because I didn't find anything so bad.
But I didn't
maybe
either.
They thought they fixed it up. Maybe they thought they improved it or something, but they don't say that. If they did improve it, why do they need to say that? I don't know.
Right, and I kept looking for something that was out of line, and I didn't pick up on it. Okay, American credulity, reticence in British public opinion, British lies, a comparison with America, swine in a model piggery, the church's cunning wisdom, the evolution of knowledge and good faith, exit the Pope, hatred of the clergy in Spain, Serrano Sr., the gravedigger of modern Spain. Conversation turned to a book entitled One, that's J-U-A-N, in America, which Bormann had recently lent to the Führer. In it, the author paints a picture of the unbelievable conditions which reigned in the intellectual and political circles of the United States and of the astonishing credulity of the American citizen. Huell stated that this credulity was not an exclusively American characteristic, and that in Britain, too, the people swallowed everything they were told. Hitler said, "This reminds me of the Hauser reunion, which I attended in Stuttgart, where exactly the same sort of thing occurred. The fellow who was either an idiot, a madman, or a first-class swindler, heaped a torrent of abuse on his audience, calling them swine, oxen, beasts, and so forth, although in point of fact, the majority were very respectable people. Once, in some election in Munich, this fellow Hauser got 29,000 votes because the voters confused the name and thought that the Hauser Party represented the interests of the householders. In the same election, Stresemann, the Chancellor of the Reich, obtained only 27,000 votes. Field Marshal Keitel expressed the opinion that we had much the same situation now with the Bible students, Bibelforscher. Hitler replied, "That sort of thing must be stamped out. If society surrenders to antisocial tendencies of this kind, it will disintegrate. We must not tolerate it. Even by the law of the jungle, the antisocial elements among the beasts are annihilated. If they are not, we might well have a repetition of our experiences in 1918 and see these elements in a moment of national weakness usurp power. During the First World War, major operations generally came to an end about the end of November or the beginning of December, and the front became comparatively quiet. I remember well that we had some very hard fighting at the end of October 1918, and then on the 27th, down came the rain, and everything was washed out. Since then, however, we have had some pretty rigorous experiences on the Eastern Front in this war, of which our Western enemies can have no idea. Why, I wonder, did the British spend the whole of March talking about the spring offensive? For March in England is the spring. Thanks to the riches of their colonial empire, the British have naturally become a nation of rulers. And oh, beauty of their country seat and the grandeur of their estates. It is perfectly true that the British swallow everything they're told. At the moment, nevertheless, there's a certain amount of murmuring over faked reports. To justify their bluff, those at the head of affairs are reduced to telling the discontented that these false reports are being spread in order to deceive the enemy. A large portion of intelligent Britons say, we're waging this war by bluff, and it's the only way we can wage it. Whether they believe that they are really bluffing us is a very different matter. In the autumn of 1939, they declared that there were already a million Britons in France. Even I estimated that their strength at between 35 and 40 divisions, whereas in reality, they had 12 or 15, a mere 350,000 men. I cannot imagine the publication of a deliberate lie in the German official communique but they don't mind how many they publish in their reports, and one realizes now the extent to which they are hoodwinking their own people. According to the Americans themselves, America has the finest, biggest, and most efficient of everything in the wide world. And when one then reads a book like this about them, one sees that they have the brains of a hen. Well, the disillusionment will be all the more severe, and the consternation when this house of cards collapses will be enormous. This has already occurred as far as the Far East is concerned. Why should a people of that sort fight? They've got everything they want. Anyway, the ardor for battle will soon wane when the individual finds himself called upon to endure a further curtailment of the amenities of life. It's very difficult to argue with Americans. They immediately shout, say, take a look at what our workers earn. True, but let us take a look at the shady side as well. The industrial worker earns his $80, but the man who is not in industry gets absolutely nothing. At one time, they had no less than 13 million unemployed. I've seen pictures of shelters built out of old kerosene tins, which the unemployed had erected for themselves, and which remind me of the holes of misery to be found in the Bolshevik industrial cities. I grant you that our standard of life is lower, but the German Reich has 270 opera houses, a standard of cultural existence of which they over there have no conception. They have clothes, food, cars, and a badly constructed house, but with a refrigerator. This sort of thing does not impress us. I might, with as much reason, judge the cultural level of the 16th century by the appearance of the water closets of the time, an apartment which was not then regarded as of particular importance. A few days ago, I read another book about Spain. Spaniards and Americans simply cannot understand each other. Those things which the Spaniard venerates most highly mean nothing to the American, and to the Spaniard, the American way of life is a closed book. To sum it up, the Americans live like sows in a most luxurious way. Reichsleiter Bormann drew attention to the gifts which France made almost every day to the church, and on which the power of the church was thriving mightily. The Führer continues, it was exactly the same in Bavaria. Held restored to the church forest lands to the value of 30 or 40 million marks, lands by which expropriation belonged to the states. The church has succeeded in striking a very pretty balance between life on earth and in the hereafter. On earth, they say, the poor must remain poor and blessed, for in heaven the earthly rich will get nothing, and the unfortunate poor on earth believe them. It is only by keeping the masses ignorant that the existing social order of things can be maintained. In the eyes of the faithful, this is the justification for supreme papal authority. Cramer Klett told me one day that he had become a Catholic because he realized that Luther, with his Reformation, had completely destroyed authority as such. Possibly, but I cannot help thinking that man has been endowed with a brain which he is intended to make use of, and that anything which is founded on a premise unacceptable to the human intellect cannot endure forever. It is not possible to hold fast for very long to tenets which the progress of knowledge have proved to be false. I should be wrong if I condemned as a liar a man who believed firmly in the Aristotelian or Ptolemaic world when he had no other alternative to choose from. But a man who still believes in this old conception of the world today certainly is a liar. No science remains stationary. In my eyes, the ability of mankind to reject a proven untruth is one of its virtues. By the church, the unknown is described and explained with precision. and if she advances with the times, the ground must inevitably be cut out from under her feet. For this reason, she is opposed to all progress. It adds little to our knowledge of the Creator when some parson presents to us an indifferent copy of a man as his conception, of the deity. In this respect, at least, the Mohammedan is more enlightened when he says, "To form a conception of Allah is not vouchsafed to man." The most pressing danger, as I see it, is that Christianity, by adhering to a conception of the beyond which is constantly exposed to the attacks of unceasing progress, and by binding it so closely to many of the trivialities of life which may at any moment collapse, is ripening mankind for conversion to materialistic Bolshevism. And that is a terrible tragedy. Man will lose all sense of proportion, and once he considers himself to be the Lord of the universe, it will be the end of everything. And if the church in Spain continues in the way it's going, it will end on the refuse heap. The rapidity with which Mustafa Kemal Ataturk rid himself of his parsons makes one of the most remarkable chapters in history. He hanged 39 of them out of hand, and the rest he flung out, and St. Sophia in Constantinople is now a museum. In Venice, in 1934, the Duce once said to me, "One of these days the Pope will have to leave Italy. There is not room for two masters." In the Spanish people, there is a mixture of Gothic, Frankish, and Moorish blood. One can speak of the Spaniard as one would speak of a brave anarchist. The Arabian epoch, the Arabs look down on the Turks as they do on dogs, was the most cultured, the most intellectual, in every way best and happiest epoch in Spanish history. It was followed by the period of the persecutions with its unceasing atrocities. The Russian priest was not hated. He was merely despised for the parasite he was, hanging on at all costs to his job for what it would bring him. The Russian princes, unlike the German and Spanish, were never slaves of the church. In Spain, the clergy is hated and will very soon be wiped out. All who have watched Frankl's progress say that he is heading for another revolution. The rest of the world cannot be separated from Spain by a Chinese wall. Sooner or later, the explosion must come. Here, too, we see a fundamental truth. The parasites, in their avarice, do not realize that they are destroying the very ground which is their foundation. The church of today is nothing more than a hereditary joint stock company for the exploitation of human stupidity. If I had not decided in 1936 to send him the first of our Junker aircraft, Franco would never have survived. Today, his salvation is attributed to Saint Isabella. Isabella the Catholic, the greatest harlot in history, who was decorated by the Pope with the Rose of Virtue about the same time as our Ludwig of Bavaria was all but crucified on account of Lola Montez. The real tragedy for Spain was the death of Mola. There was the real brain, the real leader. Franco came to the top like Pontius in the Creed. The most evil spirit is undoubtedly Serrano Sr., whose task it is to prepare the way for the Latin Union. In reality, he is the grave digger of modern Spain. Well, there's one powerful section there, Carolyn. And once again, he's addressing the false basis and tenets, the negative tenets of religion and how it's used to befuddle, and that eventually it was they were going to have to pay the piper.
Yeah, boy, he did some very good speaking against the church. He made a whole lot of sense. Made a whole lot of sense in this.
And, exactly so.
Yeah, and He sure doesn't like this Serrano Sr., who I just keep seeing, who I just read at his Wikipedia page before, but he's presented as a pro-national socialist more than Franco was, and you know, a real friend of Germany and so on, but there must be something hypocritical about it, because Hitler sure isn't, doesn't think so. And I guess
right.
because he was also, he promoted very close to the church. I mean, he was a pro-clerical person. So that might be the reason.
You know, when you said there was one particular line that you marked, and I'm thinking, okay, is it going to be the one that I marked? And you said that, which I thought, wow, okay, so I went right back over to it. But the line to me in this whole section that was so very important is, here too we see a fundamental truth. The parasites, in their avarice, do not realize that they're destroying the very ground which is their foundation. And then in this sentence right here, the church of today is nothing more than a hereditary joint stock company for the exploitation of human stupidity. And boy, did that jump on me like a magnet, because anytime I see the word stock company or whatever, to me, I see the six-pointed star. I mean, that's their bailiwick. That's their mode of operation, and a hereditary joint stock company for the exploitation of human stupidity. And boy, does that fit the thoughts that I've had about it. But this was really, really an entertaining little section right here.
Well, right, and I thought that when he was talking about the comparing the standard of living between the U.S. and mm-hmm. Germany, and the Americans
yes.
bragging about their standard of living and everything, and he says, well, but we have our workers don't make as much money and so on, but we have how many hundreds of opera houses throughout Germany.
Yeah.
And, you know, at one time I might have said, oh, well, you're just trying to substitute opera houses for people getting a decent wage, and maybe a lot of these people don't like opera, blah, blah. I would have had that attitude sometimes, but I don't have it now, because I think he's absolutely right in that, too, in that there's a culture going on that fills up people's, that's important to people, much more important than some of the things that we, as he says, you have a house
sure.
and a car, and your house is not built very well, but we have things that matter to us too. And that is, then again, is the community versus the individual. You know, that as a community, we have these things to enjoy.
It is.
And in the U.S., it's very individualistic, like everybody has their own, money to make themselves keep up with the Joneses and so on.
Right. But you know, it's so wonderful to see him to sit there and say, all right, I grant that the our standard of life here in Germany is lower than yours in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
But we have a culture. We have this. You have the, certainly, you have the materialistic way of life all over us. We don't have that over here. But by golly, we do have something of much more value. And that's an inner spirituality, a value of culture. And I think he drew a perfect line there of the American as materialistic and very unaware of what really goes on around them. And so to me, it was really, really a wonderful a section here that drew the line about, hey, you might earn a hell of a lot more money, your workers, than ours do. But you know, the ones that are making the big money, you also have a slew of people that don't earn a damn thing over there in the United States, and they're living in poverty. And boy, did he nail that right, because he had talked about the Great Depression and things like this. So this was one very important section.
Well, I also would like to mention that a couple other things that he was saying that he's afraid the church is going to lead the masses of people to Bolshevism and to a materialistic point of view. And that just shows that he wants the people to have a spiritual life. And he wants what he would consider a true spirituality, not what he sees in Christianity as this, what is not, you know, and it's too much serving the church and church powers and so on and persecuting people and what have you. So it's, you know, that,
well, yeah, and
that,
I've got,
that struck out to me.
Well, that's good, because, and I've got what you're, exactly what you're talking about there is, I'm right on it here. It says the most pressing danger, as I see it, is that Christianity, by adhering to a conception of the beyond, which is constantly exposed to the attacks of unceasing progress, and by binding it so closely to many of the trivialities of life, which may at any moment collapse, is ripening mankind for conversion to materialistic Bolshevism. And that is a terrible tragedy. What he's talking about there is man is selling his soul for the trinkets of materialism.
Well, but he's saying the church is doing that.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
He's saying the church is leading them to that because the church is not really satisfying what they're claiming for themselves. And when people turn away from the church, then they're going to turn to materialism because there's not going to be anything else for them. Yeah, you're right. That's what he's saying. And then there's one more sentence that when he said that, in my eyes, the ability of mankind to reject a proven untruth is one of its virtues. A great line. But the first thing that popped into my mind right away was Holocaust. And I wanted to use it for that. You know, that we have the ability to prove things that are not true, but now in this case, we're not allowed to. They don't want us to be allowed to. You know, Vincent, are you aware that Vincent Renoir was sentenced to 2 years in prison today? Or maybe it was yesterday. Well, that just came through today. I thought I'd mention it. It bothers me a lot. But anyway, I think we'll have to say goodnight now, right, Ray?
Exactly, and I wanted to once again say I apologize tremendously for missing the opening of the show in the first 30 minutes, and I'll stay awake next week, Carol. You can bet your boots on that.
I'll count on it. I hope you get over your allergies. I can hear your voice.
It's just one of those things, and it's nothing serious, and it's working its way through. So many thanks, and we're looking forward to next week.
Yes, so good night, everyone. This has been Hitler's Table Talk, and we'll see you again next week.